5 months ago, our Mega Tafari and her family were homeless in Florida. That's when they decided to do what a number of other people are doing. They found an empty house, a house that was in foreclosure and abandoned, and they moved in. Our Mega says she's ready to make her case to anyone who comes to the door.
I don't care how hard your heart is, or your head, or how much of a slumlord you are. Everybody deserves to have a place to stay, and because it just so happens to be your property doesn't mean that I'm targeting you and making you responsible. I would just really apologize to that person for, trespassing, if you will. You know, what are we supposed to do?
Armega and her husband decided they would clean the place and make friends with the neighbors and hope they'd stay under the radar of the bank. They got 5 months with a roof, but they have to leave next week. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
There may be some good news about foreclosures. National statistics for last month show some leveling off, pretty well everywhere except Florida. A number of Sunshine State cities have homes that won't sell, others with plywood on the windows. Our Mega Tafari lives in South Florida, a place called Liberty City, just outside Miami. Her husband works construction, and that's pretty spotty work these days. They have two small children. Our Mega and her family have been homeless a number of times. They were living in their van last fall when someone gave them a list of empty homes, many of them in foreclosure. I asked Armega to tell me what she saw when she first made her way to her current house in Liberty City.
Boarded up houses, boarded up apartments, boarded up stores, shops, churches, even the places that is inhabited, they still have boards on the windows and things. I guess presumptuous for the storms.
Why is the neighborhood so boarded up?
Gentrification would be the number one reason.
Yeah, what do you mean by that?
The raising of the rent. If you raise the rent at minimum wage, I can't afford to pay the rent. And then if I can't afford to pay the rent, other utilities and things of that nature, then of course I can't afford to live in that area. Mm-hmm. Then forces me out into somewhere more deplorable than the place that is already set up there. I've never been to New York, but a lot of people compare this place to New York as far as homelessness and the abandoned buildings and things of that nature.
But are they old buildings, Armega? Are they new?
Some of them are fairly old, but then you have a lot of new projects that have gone up, and for some reason or another, they're not fully completed.
And so if you were to continue this tour to your home for me, once we get onto your street, what would I see?
Really, there's nothing that really differentiates my neighborhood from the entire area, really.
I mean, how many houses on your street?
Approximately six on each side.
How many of them are being occupied by people who are, I don't know, paying rent or who own the house?
I'd say four. There's one that's for rent, and then there's one that is boarded up, yes, and the other one is kind of just like an abandoned house that is used for whatever, you know, shelter.
Did you find this place on your own, or did someone tell you about it?
It was suggested to us. We have two children, 4 and 15 months, and we had to find immediate shelter besides our van, so this was one of the options. October the 16th was when we made the final decision to move in and basically be responsible for whatever consequences may arise from us doing so.
When Armega Tafari and her family arrived at the foreclosed house, they didn't quite know what to expect. She'd heard it had been used as a crack house. I asked her what she saw on her first walk through.
Wow, yeah, I can't forget that. Feces on the floor leading to the bathroom. There were recently used condoms. Some were old and stuck to the floor. There were a lot of drug paraphernalia, the bags, the pipes, I guess, that they use, and cans and things of that nature, old clothes that they use. The bathroom, wow, we cleaned that place. It took some time and some more time. The plumbing was congested due to all of the condoms and baggies and things of that nature.
you have any idea how many people had been living in that place before you came in?
Well, according to the neighbor, there had been a tremendous amount of unwanted traffic, whether it was drug dealers or drug users or just someone looking for shelter. Both the doors were open, the front and the back door. The majority of the copper had been ripped out of the house. The hot water heater is actually a real nice stove there and a refrigerator. And it was a breath of fresh air to us because where we were coming from, where we were actually paying rent, we didn't have those luxuries. they didn't come with the apartment.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Armega says that cleaning the foreclosed crack house posed many challenges. She says it took hours of cleaning, mops, soap, water.
Bleach, Pine Sol, Dettol, Fabuloso. My husband and I, we just prayed while we cleaned because to look at that house and to think that we actually had to live in it, you know, to look at the spots on the floor where the feces and the condoms and things were at, and to think that our children had to walk over that floor. We just had to clean with enough faith, you know, that the bleach would actually do its job. Once it's a crack house and they start burning that stuff in the house, it sticks to the ceilings, the interiors of the walls and things of that nature. It's smoke.
You know, one thing I don't understand, Armega, is why you bothered with this house. If it was such a mess, why didn't you just, you know, get back in the van and go look for some other place to take your family? Why go to all this trouble to clean up a place in such awful shape?
Well, as atrocious as it sounds, my husband and I have both had jobs in the past that has consisted of the cleaning that it took to actually clean this house. So when you're doing something for your family, there is no limit, I think, you know, that you will go to. And seeing this house among the others that we had to choose from, this house was actually, I can use the word immaculate. After I've described it to you, I can actually use the word immaculate and say that in comparison to the other properties that we looked at, this place was the best place for our family. A lot of the other properties that we looked at was actually congested with old belongings of other tenants. And when we got to this house, it still was a breath of fresh air.
It's funny to hear you say we had looked at a number of other properties because it sounds like a family that's, you know, going shopping with a real estate agent. Were you looking just at houses that you knew were boarded up, houses that were being foreclosed or had been foreclosed? Is that what you were doing?
Well, to my knowledge, when we looked at this list of addresses, the safety did lie in that they were foreclosed houses and that the owners most likely didn't live in town, in state, or anything like that and wouldn't be coming.
Who was it who drew up this list for you?
There's an organization called Take Back the Land. They offered this help to us.
They're basically saying to homeless people, look, these are the houses we know that are empty. If you want to go there, that's up to you. Is that what they're saying?
Well, really, homeless families that want to help themselves. Because, first of all, let me say this. My family, we didn't allow different organizations to split us apart like how they normally would do, you know. And they think that if they split the family apart, then that would give them enough strength to come together again. But we totally disagree because staying together has given us a strength beyond compared to them saying, let's let the husband go here and the children and the mother go here.
Last month, a foreclosure representative from the bank that owns the house, actually showed up on Armega's doorstep.
It was around 9 p.m. He was an investigator sent out to find out if anybody was actually squatting in the property. And when he knocked on the door, he let me know who he was and the reason that he was there. He also informed me that the normal procedure, if they thought anybody was squatting in the house, would be to call the sheriff and have everybody evicted.
But they didn't do that with
you? No, he didn't. He basically just told me the house was going into foreclosure and they would probably just draw up some paperwork and have us evicted. And when the eviction notice came, we'd have either 30 or 60 days to leave.
If I understand you correctly, Armega, you're saying the guy was pretty reasonable with you.
Of course,
He didn't start jumping around saying, who the heck are you? What are you doing in this house? Get out right now, blah, blah, blah.
How could I open the door and not give him a respectful conversation. I mean, you're representing Washington Mutual, so I'm in your house, you know. When he walked up to the door, he seen a number of pair of shoes. We don't wear shoes in our house, you know, and he recognized that right away, and he gave respect to that, that he seen all of the shoes outside on the front porch on a big, nice, clean white rug. And then when the door was opened, he seen that the floors were nice and clean, the walls and everything was intact, and it looks like a home that's being taken care of rather than being vandalized and going to cost more money to fix if we were not staying there.
The latest word from the bank is that Armega's family has to move out at the beginning of next week. In fact, Armega made a deal with them. She and her family will leave as requested, avoiding any need for the legality of eviction papers, and they'll get $750 in exchange.
They call it a cash for keys agreement. So we're going to give them the keys, and they're going to give us the cash, and that will help us to survive. Like I said, my husband, you know, is working, and with that, maybe we'll strive to move into our next place as soon as we get the funds.
Coming up next, I'll find out from Armega just what her neighbors thought when they found her living in the abandoned, foreclosed house, mortgage-free. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. The state of Florida recorded the highest rate of house foreclosures last month. The word is that one out of every 250 homes in Florida is now in some kind of default. Armega Tafari lives in Liberty City, just north of Miami. She and her husband and their two kids moved into one of those empty homes. The place is in foreclosure. They've been squatting there now for 5 months. I asked Armega if she got any flack from the neighbors. None at all, she told me.
There is still such thing as a brother and sister's keeper, you know. Our neighbor has gone beyond the call of duty to make us comfortable. We are utilizing his water, and the way that it's connected, when it runs through the house, we have full use of it in all of the faucets, and it also flushes the toilet, you know. So
How does that work, Armega? How do you get water from a neighbor? I don't know.
Well, there are some industrial water hoses that they have at places like Home Depot's and Lowe's, garden hoses. And you just basically connect them from one of his pipes outside to one of our pipes. And the air pressure naturally alone with the water will allow it to flow through the pipes. And you have water.
And he's okay with this? He's happy to give you the water?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Huh. Is there any electrical service in the house that you have, or do you have to get that from your neighbor as well?
Yes, my neighbor is our keeper. He lives right next door to us. Like, if you fall out of our back door, you're in his yard. So it's fairly easy to just take a small cord and attach it to the back of his house. Yeah. And, you know, to keep it from being such a spectacle, you know, we came up with the idea of, you know, making it incognito through the grass and, you know, camouflage it so it doesn't look away. And then that it's safe in the aspect for when the children come out in the yard to play, so...
So the power and the water from your neighbor, are they available 24/7 or just
yes.
for some time in each day?
24/7.
You know, you're going to help me understand why it is a neighbor. He may be a wonderful guy. I don't doubt that for a moment. He sounds like he's been very generous to you. But why would somebody want to make it easy for a family to sort of squat in a foreclosed house next door? Why is he doing this for you? Have you figured that out?
Yes, I already know. He already knows the situation in death really intimately, where we were coming from. It's not like we chose to be homeless, you know. And I think that we've definitely done a good job of showing that we are not the average, I guess, homeless squatters that are just looking for a hand out, you know. We're looking for a hand up.
I think I'm following you here, Armeg. I mean, what you're telling me, if I understand you correctly, is that this guy used to have a crack house next to him, and now he's got a family that's taking care of the property. Right?
Yes, yes.
But he could still have just called the police and said, you know what? There's a bunch of homeless squatters living in the house next door. Come out, clear them out, put the plywood up, and give me, you know, peace and quiet in my neighborhood. He could have done that as well.
Right, of course. He's a very just man. He's a very just man. He doesn't see us as squatters. He sees us as a family. That the way he described it to me, he and his wife, their exact words were, when we moved in, it was a breath of fresh air because we brought life to the property.
However, Armeg Tafara and her family have been told by the bank that they have to leave next week. Armeg says she's hoping they can find a place to rent, but I asked her if she'd ever move into a foreclosed house again.
I don't have a problem with it. Honestly, I don't have a problem with it. If it comes about that we have to go into another house, say, because of bad weather, or, you know, there's no vacancies at the hotels or anything like of that nature, we had to go and find another foreclosed house. It's not a chore that our family can't handle, obviously.
Can you help me with something on that, Armega? Because I know that there will be people who are paying rent and people who are homeowners who are listening to you, and they'll be wondering to themselves, what gives you the right to just go into a house that you don't own, that you're not paying rent on, and set up camp there? How do you explain that?
Well, I wouldn't argue with them, first of all. The point that I would argue is that we are in a situation that the average help that's out there doesn't offer us a solution as far as housing is concerned, you know.
Because to go into a shelter, you'd have to split up the family, right?
Right. That's the biggest issue. And then, I mean, if someone, yeah, a homeowner would come and say, yeah, Armega, then you know you need to leave. You're not paying anybody rent or things of that nature. I'd just show him the situation. I'd be totally honest with him. And I know from experience that honesty works. I don't care how hard your heart is or your head or how much of a slumlord you are. When you're hit with reality and the truth and it's right in your face, everybody deserves to have a place to stay. And because it just so happens to be your property doesn't mean that I'm targeting you and making you responsible. I would just really apologize to that person for, I guess, trespassing, if you will. You know, what are we supposed to do?
Well, it's an interesting kind of puzzle now, you know, when you've got parts of the country, and Florida is one of them, where you have all these foreclosed homes, and they're empty, and they're boarded up, and you have a bunch of homeless people, and they're told, you know, you're on your own. I mean, it's an interesting kind of moral puzzle, whether or not you have the right to that housing.
I think it's a grace that we have been given to be offered, you know, funds to be able to relocate. But I wouldn't dare think of staying a day later than the agreed date that we have to move out. Because, like I said, it would then in turn cause unwanted and unneeded friction, you know, and that's not why we're there. When you're homeless, you have to do what you can to survive.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. And there is always a story that leads to the kind of homelessness that Armeg Tafara's family is facing. In her case, it started with a badly wired apartment they rented 5 years ago. They noticed occasional sparks from the sockets. The landlord wouldn't fix the problem, so they called the fire department, and inspectors advised Armega to take the landlord to court. But she never had that chance.
I was in the kitchen, and the outlet behind the stove. It was connected to some old wiring in a room behind the kitchen. To my knowledge, when I turned on the stove, the electricity didn't reach the burner. It didn't get hot. We had like those spiral burners. Mm-hmm. It normally would start to heating up right away when the electricity makes a contact, but there was no heat. So with there being no heat, and then I have knowledge of the electrical trouble, I turned it off right away. And I went outside. The neighbor in the backyard was talking to us about employment. Maybe 5 minutes passed, if that, and it sounded like a football team was tearing our house apart. When we turned around and looked, there was flames shooting out of the ceiling. And I went around to the front, opened the front door, and there was flames shooting out of the ceiling there, too. You could tell that the fire had started inside the wall, you know, and was shooting up. The house was fairly old, so it was burned down in less than 10 minutes completely.
You guys lost everything?
Everything. Everything.
The fire also left Armega Tafara and her family without a home. They had a chance to get a fresh start in Tallahassee, so they moved. Their first apartment there was wrecked by Hurricane Wilma. They moved again.
We had moved into a house that some real estate agents had, and we responded to it, of course, and we ended up renting the place. We had, we had a lease. Mm-hmm. Those things are so scarce around here, pardon. But we had a lease with them, and there was not a hot water heater in the house at the beginning. They agreed to have the hot water heater brought in the very next day. I was 5 months pregnant at the time, and plus I had my 3-year-old. And I was very adamant about them having a hot water heater because I was not striving to boil water every day for us to bathe. Because, like I said, I'm 5 months pregnant, you know. The guy never brought the water heater. It eventually got to the point to where I did contact the city code enforcer. Again, the city code enforcer comes, and after she leaves, there's 50 code violations for the house, $500 for each one of them. So now she's talking about prison time. This house is not even supposed to have been rented out. It has a number of unsafe structures added to it. The pool in the backyard, deplorable tadpoles and dead cat and things of that nature, you know, that we...
How much rent were you paying on this place, Armega?
$1,200 a month. The city code enforcers came, shut down the place. They prosecuted the family, gave us an eviction notice, and gave us $400 to move. Nobody under the sun, moon, and stars wanted that voucher for $400, so that left us homeless. And after calling a number of the shelters, we were advised, yes, you guys, you know, you have a van. At least you have a van. And if you don't want to separate, then our advice to you would be to sleep in the van.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. For the past 5 months, Armega and her family have been squatting in a home that's in foreclosure. Before they got there, it had been used as a crack house. They cleaned the place up and found that it was one of the best homes they'd ever had. But their time there's running out. Early next week, they've promised the bank inspector they'll be gone. I asked Armega, what's next?
A couple of days ago, some friends of our family members came over, and they heard about the situation, and they gave us a Volvo. My rule of thumb now, any vehicle that comes our way, I size it up already to make sure that our family will comfortably sleep in there, even if it's just for one night, you know. Shelter, you know, is definitely important to us, you know, but...
So what's your plan come Monday?
Well, for right now, summertime is coming, so we'll just make plans to set up reservation in the different campgrounds that they have here.
You can sleep four people in that car?
Oh, yeah, 5, 6, maybe. Just imagine now, you have a Volvo, it's an 88 hatchback. There would be no, you know, as far as our belongings, we get a storage room and, you know, just basically make ourselves comfortable in our car. We don't have a whole bunch of things in our car that's going to keep us uncomfortable, you know, like this back seat lays flat, you know, and it's enough room for myself and the children to sleep comfortably, even, like I said, if it's for one night. And it's not a permanent fixture. You know, my husband has a job and my self-employment now we are striving to put together our 501c3 that would actually benefit homeless families that are in transition and need a little assistance, you know. A helping hand goes a long way.
Armega says her plan is to set up a nonprofit agency to help other homeless people, also to run a thrift store and a food pantry for vegetarians. She's the first to recognize that the life she has been leading, squatting in a home that doesn't belong to her, would be stressful for a lot of people. She says she's lucky. She has a good family, and they're doing okay.
We sing. I homeschool my child. We spend a lot of time together, you know. I haven't spent a lot of time away from my children since I've had them, you know. Us being together all the time is strength in itself, you know.
You said that you sing.
Yes, we all sing together. I strive to get up in the mornings at 4 o'clock so the day doesn't get ahead of us, because I have quite a bit of chores to do living in the situation that we live in. So when I wake up in the morning, yes, there is a song that I sing that does give me and my family strength and energy, because I hear sometimes my husband will be walking through the house and he'll start singing it, and then I'll hear my four-year-old, he'll finish a verse, you know, and then I come behind him with another verse or whatever, you know. Music is a ministry and it is healing, you know.
Can you sing me a bit of that song?
Every day I rise, I'm giving thanks and praise for life and health. For the strength that he instills in me, I move off nothing else. For the wisdom, for the knowledge, for the power, every second, every minute, every hour. Holy Emmanuel, Selassie, Jah, Rastafari. I give thanks for life, health, and strength every day, Dick.
How do you think the past, 5 years of experiencing all these different levels of homelessness, how do you think that's changed you?
I am definitely humble, way more humble than what I used to be. If you believe that nothing is put on you more than what you can bear, then, I mean, everybody can't go through this situation. You've got to have somebody that's strong enough to look at the rest of the family and say, come on, y'all, we can make it, we can do it. We only have 2 more days left. And then you make more accomplishments and you strive to go forward. So each time has been different. That's brought me to the point to where, like I say, I am more humble, and it's given my family a passion to be able to have a heart.
Yeah, but has it also given you a passion to have a home, to own your own place?
Of course. I dream of seeing my husband roll around on a nice plush carpet with the children playing with their blocks and being able to freely move around in their yard without having to worry about being stuck by bottle glass or old hypodermic needles and, you know, drug baggies and condom papers and things of that nature strewn around the place, you know. Of course I have visions of complete euphoria, if you will, for my family. I can't allow myself to be trapped by the illusions, you know, because not everyone will own a home. I'm quite comfortable with the crumbs, if you will, because the crumbs is made from the same loaf. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
I can say this. The opportunity presented itself perfectly that we would even be able to financially take over the payments of the house that we're in right now, we would. We've been taking such good care of it and the property to, you know, of course we won't deny it, you know, if it was feasible. Just trying to pay my rent and I can feel it coming down around me and these chains.
I'll stay in touch with Armega Tafari and her family, see what happens after they leave their borrowed home next week. You can check our website at thestory.org and see photos of Armega. They were taken for us by Noel Teilhard. You can also read more about the organization Take Back the Land. Those are the people who gave the list of homes to Armega and her family. Take Back the Land steers homeless people towards vacant, foreclosed homes. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. And a look at how a nation's history lives in its own clay. See, there's a potter in North Carolina, a fellow by the name of Sid Luck, who can trace his roots all the way back to just after the Civil War. That's when his great-great-grandfather, William Henry Luck, began turning pots in Seagrove, North Carolina. Back then, it was a simple business, making the kind of pottery that people need in everyday life.
Somebody had to provide vessels for the community to store their food in, prepare their food in, and that sort of thing. And the potters did it, and they were primarily farmers that made the ware, used the clay to make usable ware for the community. And they made churns and jugs and crocks and pitchers and those kinds of things that could be used for, like, milking the cow in the crock, let it set and clabber to make butter. They made churns to churn the butter in, and jugs to store syrup in, cider in, any liquid that would keep.
Any of that pottery from that time still around?
Oh, yes. I actually have a piece that my great-grandfather made, and it was rare that anybody signed any back then, but once in a while, because he was reputed to be somewhat of a rascal anyway, but there weren't too many people at that time period, the Civil War era, a little after, that could read and write in that area. But he was from an old Confederate family, and he had been educated. He could read and write, and he would write his name on a piece once in a while.
On the bottom of the pot, as we'd see
today?
Yeah,
the one I've got's on the side. It's a large jar, a cylinder-like bowl, and it'll hold about a gallon to a gallon and a half. It's just got straight walls, like a straight wall cylinder with a lid that fits over it, that a guy found up on the Virginia line. Said, "Have you ever heard of this fella? Or do you know who this is?" And I said, "Yes, my great-grandfather." And so he asked me what it was worth, and I told him I didn't know, whatever somebody would pay for it, I guess. But he took it back, and about 3 months later he showed up with it again and said, "I think this ought to be in your family. Would you trade me a rooster?" I'd made a rooster.
A clay rooster,
yeah,
right?
A caricature of a rooster. I'd had several up. He said, "I'd like one of those roosters. Would you trade me a rooster for it?" And I said, "Absolutely."
Sid Luck's own experiences making pottery started when he was quite young and not entirely as a volunteer enterprise.
My father said that my brother and I, he was 8 and I was 10, that we had no business hanging out in swimming holes and fishing holes after the crops got laid by, and that my brother and I were to learn how to do pottery. And so I was sort of forced. My father put me right on the wheel, and you know, he would show me how to try to center it, and then I just took it from there. And it's a long process to learn how to do that, but I just determined that I was not going to allow it to whip me. I think it was important to him that I be made aware that this is part of my heritage.
I was going to ask you if it was just keeping a tradition alive or if your father was sending you down to the basement to make something useful.
Yeah, I think it was more about keeping a tradition alive. At that point, the need for all such as what we had made prior to that was gone. It had been replaced. The market had been replaced by commercial potteries, and they did all the work, made all those vessels that were needed, and, you know, dinnerware, as well as any kind of storage jars or whatever, plus the glass industry had come along, and you had mason jars to store food in, and, So there was really no need for it, but he didn't really like it when he was growing up in the early 1900s. He did not like doing it because it was depression years, a lot of the years, and he said, I've never done so much hard work for nothing in my life as making pottery.
You remember watching your father, what he could do well?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. He was good. He liked to turn larger pieces. He didn't care for the smaller stuff. Of course, as a small person at age 10, 11, 12 years old, I couldn't make the really large stuff. But he liked to turn a ball that weighed no less than 6 pounds, which is a pretty good chunk of clay.
No kidding. And you and your father would go get the clay?
Yeah, I remember going to the almond clay pond and digging.
Sure hard did. Work?
Oh, yes.
I have clay in my garden. I hate to dig in
that. Yeah, it's terrible because you stick a mattock or a pick in it, you know, it sticks to the thing, and you have to pull it off a lot of the time because it's very, very plastic, very gooey, I guess. It feels like Play-Doh.
Tell me what it was like when you started working on the wheel. What do you remember?
Well, my, I guess, most vivid memories were that it was really hard, and there are probably still splotches of mud smears on the basement walls where I would sling mud up against the wall out of, I guess you'd say, disgust. But, yeah, it was tough, but it was something that I took as a challenge, and I said, I'm not letting it whip me. I'm going to do it.
What did you make when you started out, though?
By the time I was 12 years old, I could make 200 ashtrays in one day, whipping out ashtrays. And I made another piece that I started, and they would only have like a 3/4 of a pound of clay in those. But another piece I would make, and I think it only had a 1/2 pound, was a little hot butter dish, which was just a little dish. It had a little lip on one side, and you'd stick it like a stick handle. I mean, it'd be a clay handle, but it looked like a stick on the side to pick it up with, something to melt butter in. I started out with those two pieces, I remember.
200 ashtrays a day. I mean,
yeah, well, that's some kind of boring.
I was going to ask if it was
yeah.
boring.
Yeah.
Did you make any money doing this?
No.
No pocket money at all?
Well, I made a little. I mean, but, you know, relatively speaking, it was not very much. I used to tell people years ago I couldn't have bought a used Studebaker with all the money that I ever made. And when I was 12 years old, I mean, I felt like something really special with people in there just bragging on me when I was standing there just whipping out ashtrays. They couldn't believe I was doing it.
You were a tourist attraction.
I was. I was.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Sid Luck continued to work on his pottery through high school, working at the Cole Family Pottery Shop, one of the few places selling traditional North Carolina pottery then. When it came time for graduation, Sid decided to go into the military since he knew he'd be drafted eventually. He signed up for the Marines.
I think I got out of high school on Friday, and I was at Parris Island, South Carolina, on Monday. So, yeah, it was a crap.
In Marine boot camp.
I was. I started out at Parris Island, South Carolina, ended up at Camp Lejeune for some infantry training, San Diego, California, San Francisco, California, Spain and Italy and France and Cuba. And I got sent from Cuba to Southeast Asia to, I called it the Promised Land.
Wound up in Vietnam.
Yeah, I did.
How long were you there?
I was only there 7 months, but it was the end of my enlistment. And I wasn't about to re-enlist.
Tough times.
Yeah. It was really difficult then.
And I suppose that was a 4-year period of time where you didn't actually do much pottery.
Well, I did because I was stationed at Camp Lejeune down here actually for about 2 of those years. And when I was not on a cruise in the Mediterranean, I would come home on weekends and work at Cole. So I constantly did it, yeah.
Interesting that you would keep that up.
Yeah.
It's not something that you think goes with the Marine.
No, it certainly wasn't.
Sid Luck served 4 years as a Marine, twice as long as if he'd been drafted. When he went to college, he realized he was good at chemistry. Sid figured he'd get a steady income as a chemistry teacher, and he was happy doing that. He really liked working with the kids. Working with the administration, that was another story.
I guess I was somewhat prejudiced by the Marines in that I remember an old gunnery sergeant saying to us as we left for Vietnam, when you come back, you can kiss the ground and say, this is your country, you've done your duty, and it's your country. And when I went into teaching, it didn't take me very long to realize that everybody that was giving me permission to go to the bathroom, my administrators or whatever, had been these guys who predominantly majored in PE in college and just got a draft deferment, so they didn't have to do any of that. They were draft dodgers. I'm not sure how this reflects on me, but I didn't have a lot of respect for them.
And they were the ones giving you orders, right?
They were the ones, my bosses, telling me what to do.
Was there one afternoon, one incident with a vice principal where you just said, you know what, I don't need this anymore?
Yeah, actually, it was with an associate superintendent, I guess. I had gotten a letter instructing me to attend a seminar on teaching earth science. I did it. It's 3 days. Not only that, I had to pay my motel bill. They didn't pay it. So I come back to school that fall, and it took me a couple of days to get ready for the kids, but we had 2 weeks, sometimes a week anyway, to get ready for them. And I just thought I would ask and say, hey, can I take some comp time? So I went to see the associate superintendent, and he hit the ceiling. I just made a scene about that I would even dare to ask that question. No way. So, yeah, that was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back. I said, well, I'm kind of teetering anyway. This is it. This will be my last year.
How long had you been thinking that you'd sooner be making pottery than teaching? It had always been in the back of your mind?
It's always been there, because the pottery always trumped everything. I mean, I used to tell people, in the absence of my wife, it was my first love. And for what
she
it,
may hear this.
I know. Well, I actually have done it before.
She's probably heard it before.
Yeah.
But why the draw? I mean, you could put in your teaching and turn a pot in the evening or on the weekend. What was it about pottery that pulled you so strongly?
It's the sort of immediate gratification that I get from doing pottery, that I can take just a amorphic lump of clay and make it into a form that's very pleasing. And it's almost immediate gratification, in contrast to teaching, which I like teaching. But the teaching thing, I never really knew who I was getting through to. I mean, not really. I gave tests, as does every teacher. But what a test tell you? That's sometimes not a lot, I think. But years later, I mean, even 15 years later, I get gratification from teaching, because I had a vet come by one day, Mr. Luck, I am so glad I had you for chemistry, because it was so helpful to me to get through the undergraduate into vet school.
It's a long time to wait for that gratification,
and
but nice when
dentists,
it comes.
I've heard a couple of dentists, so yeah, but that's years and years later.
But when you're making pottery.
Yeah, it's instant. I mean, it's right away.
I am curious about one thing, Sid, and I know that a lot of other people will be, because, you know, many of us do what we do and think about something else that we could be doing. Wouldn't it be great if I could be a pilot or a painter or something like that? And here I am in this office. How hard was it to put aside what was in effect a career as a chemistry teacher, because you've been doing it for nearly 20? How hard was it to just put that aside and say, now I'm my own boss?
Yeah, it was difficult, because my father... My father told me I was crazy as hell.
Wait a second. This is the father who told you to be a potter when you were 10
I know,
years old.
But he said, you'll starve to death doing this. You know, you're wasting your education and so on. So
he was serious about
this.
Oh, yeah.
This. Oh, yeah. He was serious about that. Yeah, that it was really a dumb move on my part.
What did you say to him?
I said, well, I can use the chemistry that I've used. I can make glazes, because my family never had any colorful glazes till I came along. And so I immediately started formulating colorful glazes.
So did your father ever say to you, maybe it wasn't such a bad idea?
No.
He never did.
No, no.
Too proud a man? Or?
Right, absolutely.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Sid Luck's pottery shop is a local attraction now. He'll often turn out 20 pictures in a day.
I say nobody's made an original form in 10,000 years. But I have these forms, like I make a lot of buttermilk pitchers, because I like to carry on the old tradition. Yeah. I make churns, And I make jugs. Actually, jugs are probably my favorite piece to make because they're still somewhat challenging. You have to pull up a cylinder and then close it off or shape it out a little and then
close the neck off a little bit and then open it up again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so those are right much of a challenge.
And 50 years in, you can still be challenged by a jug.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
That interests me. I would have thought that you could do them one-handed. By
well, most of the time, but I mean, it's just not a given when you start that you're going to get through. Most of the time I do. I don't fail in probably 5% of the attempts, but it's still, you know, that possibility is there.
And what would your great-grandfather, Henry, think about the work that you're doing now? Because it's pretty different from the stuff that they were making 50, 100 years ago.
Yeah, well, he was reputed to be a real stickler for making pieces really smooth. When you turn a piece on the wheel, you leave little concentric circles that we call them finger tracks, particularly on the inside. And he was reputed to be a real stickler for getting those out. He even made him some round chips so they wouldn't have any finger tracks inside, none inside or outside.
And that was the mark of a good piece.
That
for
was
him.
The mark of an excellent piece of pottery. One of the things he might say about some of mine would be, "You left some finger tracks in them," because I'm not that much of a stickler.
But the other thing that's changed, though, Sid, is that what they made, for function. What
right.
you make is not for function anymore, is it?
Pottery is something that's one that I love doing, my passion, but I don't feel like I do anything that anybody needs. I do things that people want. So
why do you say nothing that anybody needs?
Well, I guess I grew up in a poor environment where what you need is something that will keep you alive and keep you going. To have things that were not necessary.
The idea that a buttermilk pitcher would be made and then set up on a shelf for everyone to look at wasn't something.
Right, it's sort of a waste of time. you only do things that are necessary to keep yourself and society going.
I wonder what's the one thing in your day now, working as you do as a full-time potter, that gives you the most pleasure?
Just taking that ball of mud and spinning it into a wonderful shape. That's still the most satisfying thing that I do.
But it interests me that after all that time, it's just that act of having your hands on the clay
mm-hmm.
that gives you that much pleasure. I wonder if it is something that you've inherited from generations before you.
I wonder that too. I remember when I went to college, they said that you did not inherit your social traits from your ancestors, but I think there may be some instinctive behavior that is passed on through genetics that does mold your emotional being, your spiritual being.
Certainly seems to be the case in the Luck family, doesn't it?
Yep.
Sid Luck has been carrying on the legacy of the Luck family pottery, and now his sons are in on it too. One of them even works with him at the pottery shop. But Sid's most lasting legacy may be the 5-gallon whiskey jug that he plans to have glazed with his own ashes once he's left this earth. Could put it up on the shelf with that old lard jar. If you have any suggestions of stories that you'd like to hear us take a look at here on the program, I'd love to hear from you. Could get to me through our website at thestory.org, or just leave me a message on our telephone line, 1-888-966-9862. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.